Mr. Briggs, so we'll go by number 8.
Yeah, as I said earlier, we will get to those in terms of the folks who have showed up for them. I would just rather go to, in terms of the order, make sure we take care of the business items, go to item number 11 next.
Okay. Go right ahead. Item
which,
number
which 11. Which is the Pajaro River sediment total maximum daily load. Yeah, we will get back to items 8 and 9. We're just going to go in a little different order here. Item 8 is on-farm management practices, and item 9 is the Guadalupe Fund. Fear not.
Okay.
So while they're queuing this up, I'll introduce our staff who are presenting this item today. It's a very important item. The Pajaro River watershed, as you'll see, is pretty significant. It's a very significant part of our region. And the impairments are significant. The staff that have worked on this are our supervisor for the total maximum daily loads, Lisa McCann, and our staff person who has prepared the staff report, the technical document that's referenced, and that is Larry Harlan.
Thank you. Again, I'm Larry Harlan, and I will be presenting item 11 on the agenda, which is for the Pajaro River sediment TMDLs. Before I launch into the slide presentation, I wanted to mention a couple of things. As Roger indicated, it's an important project to us in that suspended sediment, excessive sediment in the watershed has contributed to the degradation of salmonid habitat. And this TMDL is designed to address those conditions. A couple of unique features with this project are that we've developed rather novel exposure-based numeric target approach, as well as this is the first TMDL before the board that is utilizing the new non-point source policy in its implementation. The recommendation is to adopt this resolution. This will require two actions on the part of the board. One action is to add to the basin plan, amend the basin plan to have the sediment TMDLs adopted for the Pajaro River, Yagas Creek, Rider Creek, as well as San Benito River. The other action item is to adopt to the basin plan land disturbance prohibition. This graphic here should help to acquaint you with the location of this watershed within our region. As I find, this is a pointer here. It drains a 1,300 square mile area. It is approximately. Let me see if I can get this pointed
over. Other way. Here's a little button.
Okay, I have one in my pocket. But okay.
There you go.
Is that it, though? Okay. It's approximately 40 miles wide at the northern section here. 90 miles in length. It drains to the Pacific Ocean and enters Monterey Bay at this location here. This graphic indicates the impaired water bodies that this TMDL will address. The Pajaro River, again, is up here in the Pacific Ocean. It trends eastbound to about this location. There's also Yagas Creek, which is this northern tributary to the Pajaro, the San Benito River, this long river segment to the south of this watershed, and Rider Creek, which is a small watershed in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It is tributary to the Corralitos Creek, which then feeds to the Pajaro River. It doesn't indicate a connection here, but there is it is a connected water body to the Pajaro River. Because we observed exceedance of the narrative water quality objective for sediment, staff created numeric targets to be protective of the most sensitive beneficial uses. These numeric targets were specific to salmonids in this TMDL. The two general categories of numeric targets include stream bed characteristics. These are to protect the spawning and rearing habitat for salmonids. And we also developed another category of numeric targets, which we're calling suspended sediment concentration and duration numeric targets. This is an exposure-based approach. Again, let me reiterate before we move to the next one that the suspended sediment numeric targets were developed via computer modeling method, and these targets were developed over a 15-year modeling period. The stream bed numeric targets were developed to ensure that the accumulation of sediment within pools would not be excessive. They also address the distribution and size of sediment within the spawning gravels, again, to protect spawning and rearing salmonid habitat. Table 2 on page 7 of your packet of the resolution contains the specific parameters for these targets. These numeric targets are the same as have been adopted for the Morro Bay and San Lorenzo River sediment TMDLs. Staff developed new suspended sediment numeric targets. These basically represent an exposure-based approach, as I mentioned earlier. The numeric targets are for 7 sub-watersheds within the greater Pajaro River watershed. This table here illustrates just one of those 7 sub-watersheds. For each of these 7 watersheds, there are 5 conditions that are represented by durations and concentrations. We have what can be considered acute exposure conditions with a 1-day high concentration exposure down to what may be considered a chronic exposure of a long duration of 49 days and a lesser suspended sediment concentration. An example, what I've highlighted here is a numeric target that is for 2 days, the concentration of a range of 665 milligrams per liter. This may occur no greater than 3 times in a 15-year period. This TMDL is unique in that there were several types of sediment sources that were identified. The TMDL is designed to address all of those sediment sources. There are a total of 8 of them. They are widely distributed throughout the watershed. And our focus was to focus and limit the cumulative impacts of each of these sources. I have a few slides that will represent some of these sources. We have the agricultural and road source category of sediment. This is indicated in these photos here. To the left, we have a small unnamed water body. I'm not certain of the name of it. I guess I should mention that these photos were obtained during the 2003-2004 rainy season under contract with the Morro Bay Sanctuary Foundation. I guess what I could mention here on the agricultural is that there could be specific actions taken to reduce the amount of sediment discharged into the water bodies that would include possibly grass waterways and other measures. Roads.
Mr. Harlan, can
yes.
I interrupt you just one
yes.
brief second? I got a note that there's a dark green pickup, a GMC Canyon with Watsonville dealer plates that's parked on Aero Vista, and its lights are on. Okay? You're welcome. Okay.
Okay, great. The photo on the right is an example of the road sediment source category that we have identified. Up top here is a road. It's New Avenue. There's a roadside drainage ditch that empties into Church Creek at this location. The flows have eroded this bank leading into the creek, resulting in sedimentation and erosive conditions. Hydro modification is another source category. We're defining it as any man-made alteration or modification to natural drainage ways. This commonly involves activities that inadequately designed drainage culverts, as well as removal of vegetation or channel modifications, whereby the channel geometries are altered or the direction of the flows are altered. In this, on the left photo, is a drainage culvert. There is some riprap material down here. It looks like it was designed to limit the energies of the flow coming through here, and hence the erosion of the stream of the banks here. There's also, we see some of these erosion or the failure of this bank here as well. It's fairly difficult in this slide to see, but there's also a great deal of erosion within the bed itself. Gunite protection up here, it looks like it's been needed on a number of occasions to take care of the erosion problems. To the right is another form of hydro modification, vegetation removal, and bank modifications and a realignment of the water body itself. This is Jones Creek, tributary to Yagas Creek. Urban sediment source, I believe most of us are aware of this or familiar at least with this type of sediment source. As well as natural erosion. Let me just make a quick comment that sediment is very difficult to separate what is natural and what is not natural. This is an illustration of a natural erosional feature in the San Bernardino River watershed. These are additional sediment sources in which I have not provided photographs for. Include grazing, mining, timber harvest, and rural properties. The rural properties are basically those properties that house farm animals or boarding facilities. Here I want to discuss the allocations. In a similar fashion to the numeric targets for suspended sediment, the allocations are based, are developed for each major sub-watershed of the seven total. They are arranged by source category that are mentioned, listed here. The allocations are expressed as metric tons, annual metric tons. For urban lands, waste load allocations are developed for those activities that are permitted. In this case, urban lands under their stormwater permit. As in this example for this sub-watershed, we have a total load of just under 40,000 metric tons per year. The total load for the entire watershed is around 185,000 metric tons per year. I wanted to mention that the allocations will not be the measure of TMDL compliance. TMDL compliance will be measured as attainment of the numeric targets are established. So the numeric targets themselves are a better indicator of beneficial use protection.
Mr. Mr. Harlan, those, if, could you go back to that slide? Those numbers are in what denomination?
Metric tons.
Metric tons, okay. And so each of those categories generates that quantity of metric tons?
Correct. Metric tons of sediment per year.
Okay.
Again, these were the average annual amounts over a 15-year modeling period. So
I know, you know, didn't we get a CD in our package
yes.
to look at?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I reviewed that. That was what, mud in the right. Pajaro?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Kind of, there was a big emphasis on the mining operation.
Yes.
Is that still active?
There are a number of permitted mining activities in the San Benito, primarily in the San Benito River watershed. They operate intermittently, depending on, apparently, from what I understand, they operate intermittently dependent upon the demand for them to supply materials. I believe there are about 6 to 8 operations currently. Of those that are currently active, I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
For implementation of this TMDL, we will rely upon conditional waivers for agriculture and timber harvesting for the control of agricultural and timber sediment sources. Stormwater permits will be utilized to control urban sediment sources. For the sand and gravel mining activities that Mr. Young referred to, staff will review existing waste discharge requirements and revise or require additional assessment activities on the part of these operations.
Can I ask a question on that? Can you go back to the previous slide? I'm sorry, I'm so slow. But it just, I'm talking, excuse me, the first bullet there, conditional waivers for irrigated agriculture. Is that going to be on top of their ag waivers as well? Or does that replace?
We will be relying upon the existing irrigated agricultural waiver. There will be no additional requirements or okay. no additional implementation activities.
I just don't want to make a burden on agriculture and think that they have to do one permit, and which what you're saying is correct. Okay. As long as they have to do one.
Right, existing, it's to rely upon existing current activities. No additional activities on the part of agricultural.
Now, do we have any timber in that area?
Within the watershed itself, yes, we do. Those are primarily located in the San Benito County, in the Santa Cruz Mountain areas.
So there's a part of the timber that kind of goes on over the hill into the Santa Clara County area, and we had at least one timber harvest last year that was in that watershed.
So that'd be in the Mount Madonna area? Is that?
I don't know.
I'm just trying to think of the drainage area. Into
It was west of Gilroy, in that area.
That's about right.
Yeah.
To my knowledge, the majority of timber harvest activities occur within the Santa Cruz Mountains and Santa Cruz counties. A portion does go over to the westernmost set portion of Santa Clara County. The main water body within these areas that I'm aware of is Corralitos Creek.
In this slide that you have up, when you speak of grazing, was that the rangeland category that was on the... Okay.
Correct. Implementation of TMDL implementation for these activities what this does is we have 4 categories up here that are all non-point source in nature. As such, we are required to be consistent and be consistent with the new non-point source policy. This policy requires us to mandate regulation of these non-point sources via waste discharge requirements, waivers, or prohibition. We have chosen to use the land disturbance prohibition for this TMDL. That will prohibit the controllable discharge of sediment within the entire watershed. It is activity specific to these activities and these types of non-point sources. It will require the dischargers to develop non-point source implementation programs that are to also be consistent with the policy. The requirements of those programs include that these dischargers identify the beneficial uses they are to protect, the implementation measures they wish to employ, and also other measures in which to assure that their methods are effective. And let me make sure I didn't forget something for this slide.
Are you going to issue permits for grazing? I mean, you know, I noticed that rangeland grazing was a fairly large source. And when you speak of controlling or prohibiting activity, how are you going to do it to properties that are not currently being regulated by us?
I'm thinking ahead to the next slide because I was going to move into that a little bit.
Okay.
The land disturbance prohibition, as I mentioned, will bring on new requirements for these non-point sources. We have in this prohibition allowed a fairly large amount of time in which to develop the outreach and education elements necessary to engage the stakeholders and make them aware, one, of the prohibition, and to foster outreach and cooperation for them to be in compliance with the prohibition. This prohibition will require a somewhat large effort on the part of staff to actually identify each of these individual parties and identify their operations initially. And that goes for all of these non-point sources. So there will be identification and notification of these parties of these.
The implementation plan doesn't call for issuing waste discharge requirements or permits to these facilities, but in order to avoid the prohibition of discharge, they need to complete the non-point source management plan. So that's the regulatory vehicle. Either they have to stop all controllable discharges within 3 years after EPA approval, or they have to have an approved management plan.
Okay.
So there's always the alternative to issue permits instead. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say. So the specific requirement is that they have to report this plan to us, and it does have to be approved by the executive officer.
Okay.
Or the alternative is that they can submit documentation indicating that they are not discharging and have that approved by the executive officer.
Does natural sedimentation erosion fit into your category of a controllable discharge?
No.
No. So it would then be just man-induced erosion that you would be looking to control.
Right, but any anthropogenic exacerbation of natural erosion would fall within this.
Okay. Mr. Shawcross.
Just to prove there's no issue too small to talk about. In the second bullet up there, you call it a land disturbance prohibition. Isn't it really more of a discharge prohibition? I mean, if someone disturbs their land and nothing is discharged, I'm just wondering if that's not confusing to people. And maybe that's just in the staff report and not in any official document.
I think it's phrased that way because there are other similar prohibitions in the basin plan, and that's what that section of the basin plan is called, but
it is
a discharge prohibition. The only thing we can prohibit is discharges. We can't prohibit people from disturbing land.
I
think it's kind of an archaic term at this point.
But. Thanks.
We received comments from a variety of parties. The parties are listed up here on this slide here. These comments are included in attachment G of your package. Our response to the comments are also included. There were some revisions to the original documents in response to these comments. Those are also included in attachment G and how we altered our documents in response to these comments. The actual letters themselves were not included in the package because the comments were captured in the full context in which they were presented. So that's one reason why we didn't include the letters. There were two supplemental sheets that we prepared in response to comments we received after the staff report was prepared. The first supplemental sheet was submitted to provide you with comments from Lois Robbins. She submitted a cover letter as well as a video of the Paroa River. The second supplemental sheet was staff's response to comments made by the Sierra Club. I'd like to mention that both these comments were in support of the TMDL. So in conclusion, the recommendation for this item is to adopt Resolution R3-2005-0132, which will require two actions on the part of the board. One is to establish a basin plan amendment for the Pajaro River watershed, TMDLs, and include the Pajaro River, Yagas Creek, Ryder Creek, and the San Benito River. And the other action is to establish the land disturbance prohibition.
And can we do that just by adopting a resolution? Or are there two action items before us?
Yes. Well, let me defer to our council.
Objection. Yeah.
Okay.
Is that a yes?
Yes, good. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yes.
Dr. Press.
May I make one? I forgot to mention something important that in one of the supplemental sheets, there is a typographical error correction that was also be considered as part of the adoption of this resolution.
Okay.
I also have a question about the language of Amendment Number 2 on page 11. The first exception to the prohibition says that the prohibitions don't apply to discharges regulated by existing permits. Do we really mean existing, or should that word be stricken? Because if we were to issue permits in the future, that would be an exemption from the prohibition as well.
That's a good point. Should we remove it? Existing.
It's right in the middle of the page.
Yes, I'd recommend striking the term existing.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Press.
Well, this is a very complex problem, one that will take a long time. When the staff report says it'll take 45 years to achieve, then you know it's going to take a long time. Because if the staff says 45 years, whoa. So in light of that, also on page 11 of the resolution, staff writes that three-year reviews will continue until the TMDLs are achieved. I suppose that this is a process in which we adopt numeric targets. We work with stakeholders and interested parties. We learn, we adapt, we learn, we adapt. So I would expect that you would be coming back before us, not just with reports on how whether we're achieving the numeric targets, but also with some changes, suggested changes to those targets and therefore the allocations. Right?
That's correct.
Right. Okay. So this raises a kind of almost philosophical question. Do you start with very aggressive numeric targets and therefore more aggressive, smaller allocations in the TMDL program, or do you try to do something that you think is achievable and then scale it back? Now, I raise this particularly because in the comment section in section G, Dr. Los Huertos argued that selecting, because what you've done is you've got your numeric targets that are derived from the Newcomb severity of ill effects model for the salmonids. He's critiquing the point in that severity model that you targeted the sediment targets to, arguing that a severity level of 8 is the upper range of what did he say, the upper range of sublethal effects to salmonids, and had you come down, he'd have a little more confidence in the subsequent numeric targets. So my question is, why 8? Why not 7, 6, 5? And if you went lower, what would be the consequent effect on the numeric targets and then the allocations? And if you could pose it as maybe a percentage. So if you went down to if you had pegged it at SEV 7 or 6, how would that change the numeric targets in table 2, if at all? Would they be lower by some linear percentage, or would you, or not? You follow me?
Yes, that's a fairly, I don't know if I can put it in the percentage context that well. As you did mention, it was a very complex computer simulation model, and the SEV8 level of protection was selected for a number of reasons. Those are included on, I believe, pages 12 and 13 of the project report. This level of protection was based primarily on the results of the modeling exercise itself, where the conditions of the watershed were parameterized or formed a scenario in which all the anthropogenic sources were eliminated. So it would probably, I guess, could be classified or considered pristine conditions in which there was no unnatural sources of sediment. Under this scenario, there were still conditions that were above this SEV8 numeric target threshold, indicating the watershed itself is highly productive in sediment supply, that establishing a greater level of protection at SEV7 level would most likely be unattainable. We aren't convinced one or the other. We have planned continue or begin evaluating the appropriateness of these numeric targets, which will take some time and effort. And there are But the SUV and the SUV8 section of that, let's say, exposure category or protection level wasn't based primarily on one overlying or one primary factor. It was a number of other factors of lesser degree, whereby the data presented in the Newcomen-Jensen model is representative of Salmonid populations that are not resident of our watersheds here, or even in this in California. They're primarily laboratory species that may have, or species from northwestern portion of the United States that may have more sensitive requirements, as opposed to ones that may be more resilient here in Central Coast, for example. I wanted, if I need to clarify anything, please let me know. But let me also go back to your comment about the period in which this TMDL will be evaluated, the attainment of 45 years. It appears I don't know what your opinion is of that, but the reason we set such a long duration is because the stream bed numeric targets were developed by a researcher who noted that improvements in upslope conditions will not be realized in these stream bed parameters for a period of at least 45 years, so that we would not be able to evaluate the effectiveness of any type of implementation activities upstream for that length of period for these stream bed numeric targets.
Okay. All right, so you answered part of my question, but the part that I want to try to get at is what happens if we select targets more aggressively based on a different end of the modeling. So, I mean, do you have any objection to numeric targets that would be more aggressive than the ones in Table 2? Actually, why don't I back up a little bit? How far off or how close to reality are these numeric targets? If you pick the Upper Pajaro section that you broke out for us on the slide, so for example, you had durations,
no,
you know, for one day, 1,808 milligrams per liter. Is that have we observed maximum concentrations of twice that or three times that? How far off from that are we? From that first one, or even the one that you have in yellow for a 2 day?
How far off are we?
Yeah,
in observed
yes.
Streams? I'm not certain. I don't have the answer to that. We don't have the data necessary to evaluate that specifically right now.
Okay, so we don't have a baseline for each of these duration categories. In other words,
Right.
Okay. So we don't know how far we have to come.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
We don't have data for this particular sub-watershed. But
okay.
We do have some short-term data, if you're talking about the context of the 15 years, for Yagas and Yuvas. And this is actually data that was developed by UCSC and Mark Lasuertos.
Yeah.
And he indicates that he's already seeing some concentrations and exposures that do meet numeric targets in those tributaries. So from that information, we're not that far off in
okay.
some reaches.
All right.
But
so
these are over short periods, and
right.
it's designed to be longer term in terms of the dynamics and of sediment and
streams. Right, right. These are for some reaches and some of the time, and but staff is arguing that right now there's impairment for sediment, right? So in any event, we should be moving towards less sediment. Mm-hmm. So where I'm headed, obviously, is for numeric targets that are a little tighter than what we have here. And so I guess my question is, do you see any reason, any very strong objection to reducing these and being a little more forceful. I don't know whether that would be by going with by changing, just saying 20% less or 15% less, because I'm not, I know better than to assume a linear relationship between some model and then, you know, okay? So what can you tell me?
Did you say? Hang on a second, please. Yeah, I heard you.
Okay. Any other board questions?
Yeah, I have.
I'm waiting for an answer.
Okay. But is anyone else lining up for questions? We have.
I just have one.
Okay, and then we do have two speaker cards. If there's anyone else in the public that wanted to speak, other than Mary Ellen Dick and David Drew, I'm not going to speaker. I'm just trying to solicit more cards so that we know what's going on.
In response to your question, Dr. Press, the numeric targets that were represented in the table that we those are indicative of significant reductions from majority of the non-point sources or other sources. If these sources were reduced even greater to 100%, we would again have exceedance or occasions in which these SEV8 categories on the indicated by days and concentrations would be exceeded. So even with the 100% reduction, we're still going to have these conditions that would be greater than SEV8.
Right.
So if it were at SEV7, we would experience greater occurrences or more numerous occasions in which these numeric targets would not be.
Okay, I guess it comes to a matter of what are we targeting here? What are we aiming for? And I guess I'm feeling that we should be aiming more ambitiously. As long as we know and we understand that this is going to take time and that it's an iterative process, to use that hackneyed phrase. Why wouldn't we be a little more aggressive here? It sounds as though sometimes these targets are indicative of what's already happening in some reaches. Why not? I'm sorry I had to take up the board time on this, but once you lock these in, they're in for a while. And I want to know why we shouldn't tighten them up by 10%, 15%, or 20%. Since we know that it's going to take a long time anyway, and that we're going to have to gather data back and forth.
Okay, I'm going to give you an indirect answer. We're not necessarily opposed to considering more stringent targets as far as our recommendation, but we do not have the values modeled and developed based on a different SEV condition, which is just an outcome of the way the contract was let and the work was done by our contractor for the modeling. So if we decide to do that, and if that's the desire, then we would need to go back and develop those numbers.
See, I would favor doing some modeling that showed a range, or maybe three scenarios of numeric targets, with a little bit of more discussion about the complexity or the difficulty, I should say, of reaching each, as well as some relationship to what we know about current conditions. So current conditions, and then modeling SEV 8, 6, 4, and the subsequent numeric targets, and then closing it up with some discussion about the difficulty or the time frame that it would take. I think that would make me feel like I could go back and report to the constituencies in the region that yes, this is an aggressive model, we chose the middle aggressive model between the most and the least. I don't know. I know this would delay it, but I would prefer that.
Mr. Brick, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess it's a comment slash question. If the end result of this, in terms of what happens on the ground, and that's really the important thing, is what is the effect in terms of how we're leveraging this work into actual changes on the ground? And if the net effect is that these management plans are to be prepared and they're to be followed, and I appreciate what you're saying in terms of wanting to be aggressive as possible, but my question is, do you think there would be any significant change in terms of the management plans that are turned in if we have level 7 versus level 8? And therefore, would there be any real change in terms of the actual improvements that we'd see on the ground?
More stringent allocations will not change any of the implementation measures themselves. Let me
add to that. Because we're dealing with sources that we haven't ever regulated before, and we don't actually know yet exactly what will be in those management plans, except by what's in some studies from some places that may or may not be relevant to what gets implemented at individual parcel level here, I think it's really difficult for us to be able to say for sure, A, whether all the best implementation of all the management measures that are now known to be available will or will not get us to these numbers. That's part of the wisdom or opportunity for the adaptive management approach. But as far as what we would be recommending for implementation if we had more stringent targets, I don't think we would be proposing anything different, because we've deliberately designed a flexible implementation program in order to figure out what the measures are on the ground, how distributed, does it mean everywhere, everybody, at what level, and what kind of information and improvements do we get in response to that, and how close to some numbers, either the ones that are proposed or, if the will of the board and the decision ends up being more stringent numbers, and we just need to go run the experiment to find that out.
Well, at what point in time would you anticipate having, you know, data that then could justify tighter targets?
Well, the suspended sediment concentration duration targets are designed to be over a 15-year period. So we can't really evaluate target compliance until we've had at least 15 years of monitoring. And we don't have monitoring stations ready to go next week. So we're at least talking about it, you know, best guess would be a 20-year time frame in order to have that data developed and be able to report back on that and be able to do that kind of an evaluation. But, as we mentioned earlier, the opportunity to do some short-term looking at what levels are we seeing in 5-year time frames or relative to implementation efforts is still a possibility.
What is the shortest time frame that really makes statistical sense to look at to tell us what the broader picture?
I sure don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. But I guess it depends on weather and all kinds of other factors and mm-hmm. El Nino events and things like that.
But wouldn't the, in the short term, the real proof of the pudding is the management measures that are put into place. And then what really takes a long time is for those to come to fruition in mm-hmm. terms of actually showing up in terms of sediment load reductions in the river, right? But in the short term, we're looking for improvements in land use practices on the ground. Mm-hmm. Very short term.
Yes.
I think the thing that's troubling, and I guess it's inherent in the this policy tool and in the problem, is that if you say that lowering the numeric target has no change, no bearing on the management plan, you're saying that the management plans are their connection to loads are unknowable right at this point, which I think is a fairly safe thing to say, and that's troubling. It's troubling scientifically, and it's troubling from a public accountability perspective, because basically what you're saying is we have a problem. These are the sorts of things that will address them, but we don't know how much of each of these management practices needs to be implemented to get down there. So so I can be more aggressive, or we can be less aggressive, but it really, we really don't know what's going to happen. Anyway, so I guess as long as we're able to, I think we have to be able to adapt more quickly than 15 or 20 years. So when you ask what the time period that is statistically valid, that depends on the question. You can have two seasons worth of data and two data points and start to take action on that. You can have 15 data points. And there are data for some of these reaches already, so mm-hmm. it's not like we don't have any baseline data. I would urge that we plan on moving and acting more frequently on new data.
Is the 3-year review period?
Well, at least.
Okay. Well, that's what's proposed.
No, I know.
Okay.
But okay. It's like it's okay. Okay. So you give up tighter numeric targets now, but I think it means that that lots of good data have to be collected right away for the whole 3-year period, and then we have to be willing to change the numeric targets after 3 years, even though we might, even though you've told us that 15 years worth of data would be better, 20 years worth of data would be better.
I have a follow-up question to that, just based on the legal standard for developing numeric targets. They need to be reasonably expected to achieve water quality objectives, and based on what you know now and the data you have now, your conclusion is that these numeric targets meet that standard. And because CalEPA has expressed a lot of interest in scientific bases and scientific mm-hmm. justification, it's your testimony that there is a scientific basis for the SEV8 target and for these numeric objectives, even though there may be some justification for an even lower objective at this point, or lower target?
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Let's see if I can. I was interested in comments that were made, public comments in the documents we received concerning percentage of reduction. So there's a relationship there between the numeric targets, but essentially, there's some concern about the ability to reduce excess sediment 100%. Which would take it back to background conditions. I noticed the response mentions a 90% expectation or reduction required. And then I also noticed in the de minimis impact finding, which is attachment E, the number percentage there is 65% reduction. And so I found those three numbers kind of not clear to me. First of all, is 100% reduction, is that something that relates to how those numeric targets are going to be utilized to understand 100% reduction? And is that a practical and reasonable approach? Can we actually accomplish that complete reduction from impacts of economic and traditional kinds of uses that are causing this excess sediment?
Were you referring to a specific comment in the
attachment? Well, there were several that mentioned the 100% reduction. I can tell you there's one on page 11 of attachment G, but there were others.
Okay, we modified the recommendation in response to those, so we aren't saying that we agree that it might it's probably unreasonable to achieve a 100% reduction, and we modified the requirements and language in the documents in response to that. So we're not proposing or expecting or claiming that 100% reduction will be achieved or should be achieved at all. I haven't had a chance to look where you found the 65%, but we based the 90% on four categories where we had references that said that by a certain suite of management measures that have been tested on this particular source, you could achieve a 90% reduction in your sediment load.
And so do you have any idea where the 65% was developed initially?
That's
attachment E. It's the California Department of Fish and Game Certificate of Fee Exemption, De Minimis Impact Finding.
Yes, I believe that 65% reduction is reflective of the existing conditions, the loads of existing conditions, and what the reductions distributed throughout all the various source categories.
Oh, I see.
The total reduction within the watershed would be 65%.
Okay, that helps. Thank you. Quickly, just on these time frames for the existing programs that are going to work to help accomplish implementation of this TMDL, what is the time frame for stormwater management, and what is the time frame for the non-point source program?
I'm aware, regarding stormwater permits, I'm aware of one active, one approved permit that is for the city of Morgan Hill.
Mm-hmm.
There is one proposed now for Hollister that's, I believe, up for public comment.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Gilroy, as well as Watsonville, we are not at a point now to finalize or approve of those management plans. So I don't know the exact timing of these other permits yet.
Those permits are in process, though, and they have independent requirements under the Clean Water Act to move forward with their stormwater management plans.
Do we have a deadline for that? Is there an ultimate deadline when we have to have all our stormwater?
But all those four permits will be before the board within 6 months.
Okay.
So if approved by the board when they come, then they will be in place with their requirements within 6 months.
Okay. And for the non-point source, is there a time frame for the non-point source program?
So are you referring in general to the four categories that'll be
mm-hmm.
that are under the discharge prohibition called the land disturbance prohibition?
Right.
Yes. And it's let's see if I can say this right without looking at the description. So it's approximately within 3 years would be when we would expect submittals. And that's based on time after the TMDL is approved by the Office of Administrative Law, and then the language says within a year, I can't remember, a year
mm-hmm.
after approval,
so
there'll be notification and, well, we estimate three.
Okay.
A year until approval by OAL, and then a year for us to notify and do outreach, and then a year
Okay.
for them to actually develop their plans and submit.
Thank you.
And what the basin plan language actually says is that the prohibition takes effect 3 years after approval. So whether, you know, if all these management plans aren't in place for a particular discharge, by that date they have to stop discharging.
Okay. Any other board questions at this time? All right. I have two speaker cards. Can we go to speakers? David Drury and then Mary Ellen Dick.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Dave Drury with the Santa Clara Valley Water District from San Jose, California. Thank you very much for allowing me to make a few comments this morning. I had the personal pleasure of working on the stakeholder groups with your staff, and I commend their efforts on this and the nitrate TMDL. The Santa Clara Valley Water District provides water supply, flood protection, and stream stewardship services to the residents and communities of Santa Clara County. Our mission is a healthy, safe, and enhanced quality of living in Santa Clara County through watershed stewardship and comprehensive management of water resources in a practical, cost-effective, and environmentally sensitive manner. The district works collaboratively with other agencies to achieve our mission and has specifically been working with the cities, the County of Santa Clara, and other stakeholders in a water resources protection collaborative to better regulate land uses near streams to protect our water resources. The district finds that the TMDL is consistent with our mission and supports its adoption by the Water Board and appreciates the regional approaches to resource management contained in the TMDL for hydro modification, urban runoff, and sand and gravel mining operations. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Ellen Dick.
I want to thank you, Chairman and Board, for hearing me. I'm Mary Ellen Dick. I work for the Santa Clara and San Benito Farm Bureaus and for the Central Coast Ag Water Quality Coalition. So I have spent the last 4 years working with the growers in Santa Clara and San Benito County and then with my peers in the other six Central Coast counties on implementing the whole ag waiver implementation, the whole water quality education for the farmers. So I've got a lot of on-the-ground experience on what these things really look like. I want to thank your staff for the work they've done, including all of us on the stakeholder group as we've been working through this. We've spent a lot of time with it. The staff also came down to meet with growers just as when the public document came out so that we could talk about it. The things I guess I would like to say about this, and we did submit a letter, and staff has heard many of my comments before, but this is highly erosive naturally in this area. You know, as staff has stated, most of the sediment is natural. Over 40% is natural right off the bat. Is right on the list of sources, and then another more than 40% comes from the rangeland areas. So whether because of the activities of the ranchers there or because of the fact that it's just on rangeland and is naturally eroding. So this is going to be a long-term process. We appreciate doing this as a long-term view with adaptive management. We've seen with the Ag Waiver Program for the irrigated agriculture that this is a long, slow process of getting the word out to people, doing the education. The farmers are very interested in doing the right thing. They have been very active in my meetings and in coming to the classes. Of all of the over almost 900 growers in the Santa Clara and San Benito counties, we have had almost 50% have been through classes and are working on their farm plans or put their plans into place. So, you know, we are not in resistance mode. But we want an understanding that what we're trying to do here is do this the right way and make changes that make a difference. These are expensive changes, and people want to do it. I think some of the key issues we'd like to bring up is that as we're doing the monitoring, we'd like to be sure we use the existing monitoring programs as much as possible and not build a whole new infrastructure that's going to add costs. We want to use the existing regulatory mechanisms. So we would like what the ranchers are trying to do is also take ag water quality classes and do the plans that are similar to the ones for irrigated ag so we have consistency in the message. We want to recognize, though, we want you to recognize that we're talking about a lot of sources that are not regulated. So it's a lot of, you're talking about rural residential is a major source. I mean, there isn't any mechanisms right now for regulating rural residential, and rural residential is thoroughly, thoroughly intermixed with ag land at this point, and more so as developments are allowed to piecemeal and hopscotch across ag land. So the county parks and the small city MS4 permits, the county roads, they're all underfunded. So this is going to take a long time in terms of getting out the education. Programs like the one that the Farm Bureau and the Ag Coalition are doing for me were grant-funded. I mean, I look at my funding out in 6 months increments. Do I still have work? So we think it's very important that you put a lot of time and effort into the education and funding of making these programs work. And finally, the last thing we'd like to request is a closer working with some of the other regulatory agencies. You saw some pictures of farmland where it's you know, where the ground has been tilled right up to the edge of the soil. The Department of the California Department of Agriculture and some of the pesticide permits, when they have any pest problems, they get out there, they send out things. They say, burn any grasses, get rid of any weeds, clean the edges of your farms. Right? It's a direct conflict to the message that we're trying to give about putting in buffer lands and cover strips. So you need to be working with them so that, I mean, I constantly get calls from farmers. What am I supposed to do? DFG wants me to do this. You want me to do that. So please, work together.
Thank you very much for your comments. Staff, what can be done about that if there are, you know, I've seen this before where there's agencies that kind of have conflicting goals in terms of land use. Do we have any mechanism to at least create a dialogue with?
We're going to let Amanda Byrne, who's implementing our conditional ag waiver, speak to that, because we're going to piggyback on efforts that they've already started in implementing this TMDA.
Okay. And just so the board knows, we want to get to Monarch Grove by 10:15.
Oh.
Okay. And we want to get to item number 8 before that. Okay. So we're going to try to expedite this and get this wrapped up as quickly as we can.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Amanda Byrne. I am item number 8 on farm management practices. And in the staff report that I wrote, I specifically talked about this case of the conflict of non-crop vegetation. And we became aware of this issue about 2 or 3 years ago. The Monterey County RCD is beginning to organize an effort to bring together all of these different groups of people. For example, the Department of Food and Ag, they may not want crop vegetation there because they're afraid of it spreading plant diseases. So sometimes they send out notices to growers telling them, please remove any non-crop vegetation from your ditches. Also, the produce buyers themselves also don't want non-crop vegetation there. They're concerned that mice and other animals will live in it and then become entrained in the harvesting process and then end up in someone's produce in the grocery store. The RCD is bringing those people together to talk about that issue. About 6 or 7 months ago, myself and some other personnel talked with the Department of Food and Ag. So it's an ongoing issue. I'd say we're in the discussion phase at this point.
And you're involved with that?
And I am involved with that.
Well, because Mrs. Dick brings up a good point. And it's like, you know, I've got one hand trying to do one thing while the other hand is working in an opposite direction.
Correct.
And we're just kind of defeating ourselves.
That's right. There's also a group at the State Board. They call themselves the Interagency Coordination Committee. And that group is comprised of the Department of Fish and Game, Department of Food and Ag, Department of Pesticide Regulations, state and regional boards, and several other groups to try and deal with these kinds of issues. You know, if one agency is telling the public one thing and another agency is telling them something else.
Well, keep us informed through Mr. Briggs, and if you need the board's help to leverage other agencies to cooperate, then we want to do that, and if we need to, we'll get Mr. Segundi involved in this, our man in Sacramento, and see how quickly we can, you know, try to get everybody working together.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, this is for Amanda. I'm sorry. Do you know how responsive that interagency group is? Have you talked to them or worked with them at all?
I'm sorry. Which agency did you say?
The interagency group you were talking about at this.
Well, yes, we meet on a regular basis. It's twice a year that we talk. I'd say that, you know, when you're dealing with seven or eight different state agencies. Things don't happen always quickly, but I certainly feel like that everyone is open. I feel like I've gotten a lot of good response. Certainly the Department of Food and Agriculture is, when we spoke to them about this issue, they weren't aware of it. They weren't aware that we were trying to encourage, and they are, you know, and they're speaking with us.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great idea that they're meeting and talking, but twice a year is pretty tough to get stuff done. I understand. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Any other board questions at this point? Oh, Mr. Jeffries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope my question is very simple and be answered very quickly. It's a question I've been thinking about for the last 15, 20 minutes, and the last speaker brought it up, talking about small subdivisions amongst ag. And I don't see that in your staff report. You talk about the cities and the MS4s, and you talk about gravel pits and doing their plans. So what are you doing with those? Now, I know there's a very large project that's being developed in San Miguel County. It's going to be 1,500 to 2,000 homes. That'll be handled under a different type of permit. But what about these 5, 10, 15, 20-unit subdivisions? It doesn't mention those in the staff reports.
The types of, I think what you're alluding to are the small subdivisions with that would be relatively new.
No, the ones are already established.
The ones that are already established. Those rural properties is a source that category that we have addressed in the non-point source implementation strategy. These types of activities on these properties are that we've experienced in the watershed are primarily related to farm animal and boarding, but also private roads. If these subdevelopments, one of the problematic areas of these types of developments are drainage infrastructure that is inadequate. Those would be, I guess, what we call hydro modification type activities. We have no, I'm not aware of any way in which we could prevent this development from happening or have a better hand in the types of design and planning that they have at this moment. So at this time, it would be a matter of us identifying existing problems as they exist.
Why would you identify them as non-point source when it's obvious it's a point source?
It depends upon the type of development, I haven't really thought this out very well, so this is a good question.
Well, if there's a small development that's got a storm drain system that's discharging to surface water, it is a point source. And as I recall, there's no blanket exemption from the stormwater requirements for very small developments. There's ways to request exemptions, but for small systems that are a problem, we clearly have the authority to designate them and require them to get stormwater permits or industrial permits if it's a private homeowner association.
Well, I understand anything that's in the future, especially large ones, they'll fall under a category of some type of permit which will be regulated. But I was concerned because there are a lot of small subdivisions throughout our region that are intermixed with agriculture, and they are point source, where agriculture may be non-point in some cases.
I think Ms. Dunaway is going to shed some.
Oh, okay.
Is waiting to shed some light on this.
I was hoping
just
this
a bit,
simple
just
answer.
A bit. Donette Dunaway, and I'm with the stormwater program, and I think that the way that we're trying to capture those is through the MS4 permit, where there will be some delay as things are built in, but we've got this five-year permit that's the MS4 permit. It covers the urbanized areas, which would it looks at the concentration of development. And so from that, we're pulling in some portions of the county that have a little more development than others. So it's not maybe capturing all of a county, but it will be the urbanized areas of that county. And that's where we're trying to, not we, but State Board has tried to cover those areas. So I think that's probably the best way we can do it right now.
And I think that in terms of timing, I think the answer is that for the smaller rural areas, we do have permitting authority, but obviously they're going to be low on the priority list because we have much larger municipal areas that need work on their permits first.
Well, some of my board members would say I'll be here in 45 years to see what happens. I don't think so, but I would like to know, and I'll be tracking this to see how this plays out. Thank you very much.
Can I just add something?
Sure.
I think I understood your question to refer to there is a large part of this huge watershed that has rural areas that are in county areas that are not currently designated or intended to be covered by the MS4 permit.
Absolutely.
In any way. All of the individual properties, if you will, that fall under, or property owners, I guess I should say, that fall under those four non-point source categories that we identified, grazing, hydromodification, rural properties, and roads, could be defined as an individual discharger and could be permitted as well as an individual discharger. At this time, though, we don't have evidence of who amongst those property owners are, in fact, discharging at what level and to what impact. And that's partly why we chose to approach the implementation strategy the way we did and build in time to do outreach, identify all those property owners in those various categories, and find out whether, in fact, they all or some or only one are really discharging and therefore need to be covered by permits or at least submit reasonable plans that we can approve and go with the current strategy of the non-point source policy.
Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Any other member of the public wish to address us on this matter? All right. Mr. Briggs?
Well, if you adopt the resolution, it does include the attachment, which is the basin plan amendment, so it's one action.
Okay.
And we do have the modification with the supplemental sheet and with the correction that Ms. Okun pointed out. That's it as far as changes.
And the correction that... Oh, did you say that?
I said
I'm sorry.
That.
I'd move staff recommendation.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Okay. Agenda item number 8.